Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is the Law Hour. It is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is heard nationally 7 days a week on Truth Radio and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Great American Trials, Bernard Goetz, Self-Defense and Second Amendment, when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the former editor of the New York Tribune. And here's what he said to the New York Press Association back in February of 1936. He said, "There's no such thing as a free and independent press in America unless it's in some country town. There's not one of you who dares express an honest opinion because you know beforehand it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid $150 a week for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for doing similar things. If I should permit my honest opinions to be printed in one issue of my paper, like Othello, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Our business," he said, "is to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, to sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are," he said, "the tools of rich men behind the scenes. We are intellectual prostitutes," unquote. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. These are the men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, Vanderbilts, Astors. You know, it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy along with the New World Order, why don't you call and order my four-hour compact disc package. Now, it's educational, entertaining, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now to order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send your email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at Great American Trials. Great big thick book. It's about 550 pages. Written by Edward W. Knappman. New England Publishing Associates got it over at Barnes & Noble. Softback. It covers all the major trials from 1900 to 2000, 100 years of the most sensational litigation, most sensational trials of the 20th century. Starts with the assassination, 1901, of President McKinley, and it ends with O.J. Simpson. Bernard Goetz, an odd little fellow, Bernard Hugo Goetz was his name. He was charged with attempted murder, assault, reckless endangerment, and criminal possession of a gun. He was sentenced to a year imprisonment, and a $5,000 fine, and 4 years probation. It was a sensational event, and it wrapped itself around the Second Amendment and self-defense. And the question that was to be decided is how far should an American citizen be allowed to go in the defense of his life and liberty? That was the question facing a jury in this case. It's one of the most highly charged trials New York City has ever seen. Following a 1981 beating that left him with a permanently damaged knee, Bernard Goetz, a 36-year-old electrical engineer, took to carrying a gun everywhere he went. On December 22, 1984, while riding a New York City subway, he was approached by four black youths, one of whom demanded $5. Goetz's response was to yank a revolver from a special quick-draw holster and to begin spraying bullets. As two of the youths fled, Goetz shot them in the back. One of them, Daryl Cady, fell. Goetz approached him and said, "You seem to be all right. Here's another," firing a second open-nosed bullet that severed Cady's spinal cord, and Goetz calmly left the scene and disappeared. Well, 9 days later, Goetz gave himself up at a police station in Concord, New Hampshire. Following several lengthy confessions, he was charged with 13 various offenses, all the way from attempted murder to criminal possession of a gun. Now, bringing the case to court took time, more than 2 years. Selecting a jury for such an obviously volatile trial proved almost as laborious, as neither side wanted to concede any advantage in this most critical phase of the judicial process. Eventually, after a month, a jury of 10 whites and 2 blacks was impaneled. And on April the 27th, 1987, they heard Assistant District Attorney Gregory Wapples make the opening statement or opening presentation. He outlined all of the salient facts and then said, "These terribly destructive shots were fired not by a typical New Yorker, not by a reasonable person such as yourselves responding to provocation in an appropriate and limited manner, but by an emotionally troubled individual." Goetz was, said Wapples, "a man with a passionate but very twisted and self-righteous sense of right and wrong. An emotional powder keg, one spark away from explosion." To drive home his point, Wapples highlighted Goetz's refusal to wear gloves, even on the coldest winter day, so that he might remain fast on the draw, should trouble arise. Such an obsession, the prosecutor reasoned, was far more likely to lead Goetz into conflict rather than avoid it. Now the defense attacks. Quite naturally, the defense, led by Barry Slotnick, saw things in an entirely different light. His opening statement left no doubts about their intention to turn this trial into an indictment of the aggressors. This gang of four, excoriating the gang as savages and vultures who got what the law allowed, Slotnick launched into a vitriolic attack on the character and the credibility of James Ramseur, one of the alleged assailants. 5 months after the Goetz incident, Ramseur had been arrested for participating in the savage gang rape of a pregnant woman. And to add insult to injury, thundered Slotnick, Mr. Ramseur and his friends took her earrings and her ring and left her bleeding on the rooftop landing. So heavy-handed and graphic did Slotnick depict this rape that it drew a sharp rebuke from Justice Stephen Crane, the judge. "Why don't you get off this, Mr. Slotnick?" said the judge. But the damage had already been done. The impression of the four black youths as rampaging sadists was firmly implanted in the jury's mind. This skillful defense manipulation of proceedings went a step further when one of the state's witnesses, Detective Michael Clark, referred to the four victims on the train. Slotnick was on his feet immediately. "Your Honor, I object to the characterization of the victim. That's a decision the jury will have to make." Surprisingly, Wapples yielded the point when there was no real need for him to do so, agreeing to the much meeker term young men. It was another small but important victory for the defense. Slowly, Bernard Goetz was being turned into the victim in the case, not the perpetrator. Central to the prosecution case was a taped confession that Goetz had made to the police. Because Goetz would not take the stand, this was the jury's only opportunity to hear him speak. In a rambling two-hour account, Goetz gave his version of the attack. It contained many damaging statements. Most incriminating of all was his clearly expressed intention to murder them, to hurt them, to make them suffer as much as possible. And also revealed was his aversion to being played with as a cat plays with a mouse. Several witnesses from the subway train testified. Through careful questioning, Slotnick succeeded in drawing admissions that the action had happened so quickly as to impair their recollection of what actually occurred. In particular, Slotnick created doubt about the actual number of shots fired. The intention here was to undermine the prosecution's claim that Goetz had cold-bloodedly stood over Caby and fired the fifth and most damaging shot. Slotnick desperately needed to demonstrate that his injury had occurred just in random gunfire. By far the most resistant to this line of questioning was Christopher Boucher, a San Franciscan who was vacationing in New York at the time of the shooting. Boucher testified that he initially heard gunfire, but that his view was blocked. However, he then saw Goetz standing looking down at the man in the seat. Wapples asked, "How far was the defendant from Caby?" Answer, 2 or 3 feet. Question, "Did you see the gun at any point?" Answer, "Yes." Question, "And what did the person who was sitting down do at the moment the shot was fired?" Answer, "Well, he was sitting grasping the bench and he just tightened." Slotnick, aware that this was the most damaging eyewitness testimony yet, did everything in his power to discredit it. He began by implying that Boucher had been unduly influenced by media accounts of the shooting, an allegation that Boucher strenuously denied. Next, Slotnick asked Boucher, had he not been shaken and traumatized by the violence, perhaps enough to compromise his memory? "Actually, no," Boucher replied. "That's the funny thing." Now, there was an effective demonstration, and Slotnick fared much better with Joseph Quirk. Quirk was a ballistics expert hired to recreate the crime scene in court. For the purposes of this demonstration, Slotnick had engaged the services of four black youths, dressed like street toughs, to act out the parts of the attackers. Had the defense only been interested in demonstrating bullet paths, then the color of the assailants would have been material. But the sight of four black teenagers jostling four white men in silence was inflammatory. Hard guess. Famous trial in New York. Self-defense. Right back. We'll be right back. right. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, sponsored by Truth Radio Network. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, back in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to 38 days. Now, these global 2000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, as I call them, plan to use famine, disease, plague, and pestilence to reduce Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years under the Club of Rome plan. Well, in Revelation chapter 6, the God of Israel told us exactly the same thing in essentially the same terms. He called them false prophets, war, famine, and disease. In 1920, nearly 50% of our people lived on the land as subsistence farmers, producing their own food and food for the rest of the world and for you and me. Today, we Americans have chosen to live in our cities, and today only 3% of us now live on the land. 97% of us then are no longer self-sufficient in our food production. Now, we produce grain for export all right, and then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. Our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support the Global 2000 World Population Control Program. And these globalists with the genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for. And I say, let them die for their cause, and then let you and I live for ours. If you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. My subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Bernard Goetz. He was a very famous fellow back in the 1960s, it seems to me. Maybe it was 1980s, I guess. Anyway, he shot three or four black toughs there in a New York subway. As you can see, he didn't handle himself very well. He got off on the most serious charges of attempted murder that could have put him in the slammer for quite a while. He was only convicted on the illegal gun charge. I suspect that the gun that he was carrying was concealed. Had he been carrying that gun on his hip, these toughs probably wouldn't have bothered him. It's very rare that four hoodlums will come up and attack a policeman. Policemen, as you know, carry guns on their hips. You can see that the policeman is armed and dangerous. Just watch him walk down the street. Well, any and every citizen in America can walk down any and every street in America carrying a gun just like the policeman does. Americans don't want to do that for some reason. We want to travel around unarmed, or if we're armed, we want to carry the gun like a sneaking little coward under our armpits, concealed in the top of our boot or under a belt. We don't want to carry it out in the open like the police do. And, of course, that's against the law in most states. I think there is one state, Vermont, that allows carrying concealed without a permit. And it's surprising that Goetz didn't get a permit to carry the gun. I imagine New York has a permit law. All he needed was a permit, and he could have solved 90% of his problem. But he didn't. Well, without meaning to, or without meaning to be, prosecution witness James Ramser was far and away the defense's strongest card. Ramser, one of the four youths that attacked Gatz, entered the court in prison dungarees. He was pugnacious and petulant. He was determined to face down Slotnick, and at first he refused to testify, earning for himself several citations for contempt. When he eventually condescended to take the stand, Ramser foolishly bandied words with counsel. For instance, when was the last time that you committed a crime against a human being? Asked Slotnick. When was the last time you got a drug dealer offed? Sneered Ramser. 3 days later, in sentencing Ramser for contempt, Judge Crane upbraided him for his stupidity. The judge said, "Your conduct has played right into the hands of Mr. Gatz's lawyer. He owes you a vote of thanks. Now, the jurors saw your contemptuous conduct. That can never be erased from their minds." Well, on Friday, June 12, 1987, the jury retired to consider their verdict. By the following Tuesday, they had reached agreement on all 13 counts. 12 times, jury foreman James Hurley intoned not guilty. Only once did he respond guilty, and that was to a charge of criminal possession of a weapon in the third degree. 3 months later, on October the 19th, 1987, Judge Crane passed sentence, 6 months in jail plus a fine and probation. Upon review in January of 1989, the jail sentence was increased to 1 year. The Bernard Gatz trial opened up many old wounds and left a peculiar sense of public dissatisfaction at its outcome. Many people believed that he should never have faced trial in the first place. They saw him as acting well within his rights. Others, fearful of vigilantism, added to the problem of already dangerous streets, were outraged by the jury's refusal to convict on all but the least serious charge. In the final analysis, skillful advocacy emerged as the only winner in this case. It wasn't elegant, but it was certainly effective. Now, if it hadn't been for Ramser, one of the four black hoodlums, probably Gatz would have been convicted. And that's because of his two-hour rambling statement to the police, in which he said he intended to murder him. Now, here's an important factor to keep in mind. Remember, the crime was assault and robbery. But you see, assault and robbery is not punishable by death. So when you pull a gun, you know, somebody comes up to rob you, and you pull a gun and you kill the guy, that's a wrongful death. You do not have a right to kill somebody who's in the process of robbing you. You don't have a right to kill somebody by hanging him because he stole your horse. You know, in the Old West, if they caught a horse thief, they'd take him out and hang him. Well, stealing a horse is not punishable by death. There's a punishment for theft. There's a punishment for assault. There's a punishment for robbery, but the punishment isn't death. And the only time that you have a right to kill somebody is when you are in imminent fear for your life. Now, there was a Cuban down in Florida, a very classic case. He had been robbed. He had been burglarized about, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 times. In fact, it was getting to be so regular, these burglaries, that this Cuban decided that he was going to start sleeping in his garage. So every night he'd go out and sleep in his garage. You know, you only get robbed once every 6 months. So here he was sleeping in his garage, and sure enough, here comes the burglars. There were several of them. Now, he'd armed himself. It's pitch black. And these burglars break in, and they came in. and they were inside. He doesn't turn on the lights, but he can see the silhouettes of these people. He doesn't know who they are. And he opens fire and he starts shooting, and he shot three or four of them, and he killed one. And he was charged with manslaughter or murder or wrongful death or something. And of course that just drew a tremendous response from the public, because people are just really tired of crime, and it really ticks them off, you know, when somebody breaks in. And they get what the public, what the average Joe Sixpack believes, they got their just desserts. Well, the guy was prosecuted, and the jury cut him loose. His testimony was that he was in fear of his life. And, of course, if you're in fear of your life, you've got a right to kill somebody. Now, killing these guys at night, if a thief be found breaking up in the night and you kill him, there shall no blood be shed for him. That's the way God deals with it. So if you're going to kill a thief, you kill him at night in the dark, which is what the Cuban did. And that's okay. God doesn't have a problem with that. But in this case here, did you see? Getz is riding in a lighted subway train. One kid comes up and says, "Give me $5. Had Getz pulled his gun, stuck it in this kid's face, and said, "No, sir, there's no charity here today," what do you think that kid would have done? Now, if the kid had reached out and touched Getz, and Getz pulled the trigger and put a bullet right between his eyes and killed him dead right on the floor, that's an assault for which he was in fear of his life, for which he had a right to self-defense, had a right to kill him. But these four, when they saw the gun, took off running. So they were obviously of no threat to Getz. And that's where Getz made the mistake. When people are running away from you and you shoot two of them in the back, and then you walk up to one of them, and you say, "Well, you're still wiggling," and you pull the trigger again. Oh, no. No, Getz was dead wrong. And the judge could see that. That's why the judge said to this punk, he said, "Your conduct has played right into the hands of Mr. Getz's lawyer. He owes you a vote of thanks. And the jurors saw your contemptuous conduct that can never be erased from their mind." So the jurors saw these four punks, one of them a rapist, and this one contemptuous, a real ringer. And so the jury said, "Well, let's pay these guys back in like kind." Now, Getz, on the other hand, was guilty of carrying this concealed weapon. So, you know, why don't you get a little smarter than the average guy over here, and let's remember that if you're going to carry a gun under your armpit, you need a permit. Now, Getz had been injured once before. It's very simple to go down and get a gun. Go get a gun permit to carry it concealed. It's no big deal. You have to go down to your sheriff in our state, and he'll ask a few questions. They have a form to fill out. Frankly, I think you should carry a gun on your hip. It'll do 10 times more good if you're carrying the gun out in the open. And you've got a right to carry it even in Massachusetts on your hip. Test it. It's that you don't have a right to carry guns under your armpit concealed without a permit. And that's because back in the Middle Ages, when we had knights, those knights would go out, and they'd have a big sword on one side and a big knife on the other, and they were riding a big horse with a big, long spear. These guys are trained killers. I mean, they don't make any bones about it. They're out there saying to you, in effect, "I'm here to kill you." Now, if they didn't want to kill you, then they'd walk up to you and hold out their right hand, and they'd shake hands with you. And that was to show that I'm not carrying, you know, a knife or a dirk or a a weapon here that's hidden that I'm going to stab you with and kill you. Everything that I've got's right out in the open. And that's always been Anglo-Saxon administration. We Englishmen, we Scotsmen and Irishmen and Germans and Frenchmen, you know, we have always carried our weapons right out in the open and just told everybody, you know, you mess with me, I'll kill you. And here in the Old West, you know, the cowboys, they carried a six shooter, and they carried it on their hip, carried it right out in the open. Or they'd carry a rifle in their hands, or they'd carry a rifle. You know, here in the redneck country, you know, we usually carry a rifle. Right out in the open. All right, hang on. We'll be back more when we return. We're back for the closer. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Now, your support of Truth Radio Network and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. That's truthradio.com, truthradio.com. Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution. Donations are not tax-deductible. And if they were, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. So we rely upon the financial support that comes from you, the listening audience. That helps us pay. It doesn't pay for all of it, but it helps us pay for our satellite time, our internet audio streaming, and our overhead costs. So we'd like to thank you for that continued financial support and remind you that we need your support to make Truth Radio work. Now, your donations go to Truth Radio at P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. Again, that's Truth Radio, P.O. Box 344. Napomo is N-I-P-O-M-O, California, 93444. Here's tonight's wise old saying. Nothing is impossible to the man who doesn't have to do it. All right, let's take a look at another one here. We'll get started. Tonight, this is Georgetown College versus Jones. This is from Great American Trials by Edward W. Knappman. It's published by a company called Visible Ink Press, a division of Gale Research, 835 Penobscot Building, Detroit, Michigan, 48226. Again, that's published by Visible Ink Press, a division of Gale Research, 835 Penobscot Building, Detroit, Michigan, 48226. I got this one at Barnes & Noble. It's entertaining, if nothing else. You'll love it. But it's also got the most famous cases, and the descriptions will tell you what it is that the winner did right or the winner did wrong in winning the case. It's one of probably two dozen books that I recommend to my students. I recommend them so that, like Jerry Spence wrote a book one time called With Justice for None. Jerry Spence is one of the top attorneys in the country, and when you read his book, he'll give you some of the insights on how he won this case or what was the little trick or knack that won that case. You know, you learn a little here, you learn a little there, and pretty soon one of these days you'll be in trial and you'll be facing a policeman. You'll remember Jerry Spence or you'll remember Bernard Goetz. See, the problem with Goetz is that he gave that two-hour statement. Unlike that German woman, remember, Stretz, she said, yeah, I shot him. Here's the gun. And then she shut up. she told her story to the jury, and the prosecutor got to hear her story for the first time when she told. In the case of Getz, it was the equivalent of a deposition. And then 2 years later, the guy goes to trial, and they've got his deposition, and they're going to hang him with that deposition. Of course, he gave this two-hour rambling dialogue in which he actually admitted, "I intended to kill him." As it turned out, he didn't kill any of them. He was kind of inept. He was legally incompetent. He was a fearful, timid little fellow. He was, you know, just running around with a gun in his hand, waiting to shoot somebody. And the purpose for carrying this gun now, remember, is for self-defense, not for vigilantism. Well, now, a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses went to Georgetown University Hospital. And the wife lost a lot of blood, and her husband, a JW, said no transfusion. So the hospital went to court, got a restraining order, and gave this woman a transfusion. Well, we don't know if it was against her will or not, but it was against her husband's will and over his objection, and it was upheld. Do hospitals have a right to stick blood in your vein or cut out your appendix against your will and over your objection? Well, the answer is yes, they do, and the reason is because you signed the admittance contract when you entered the hospital. Now, nobody can force you to take a blood transfusion, but once you go contract with a hospital, and then they decide that this is what they want to do, and you say, no, I don't want you to do that, you lose. So if you sign yourself into a hospital and they say, well, we think that you need a sex change operation, and you say, no, no, and then they say, well, it's in the best interest of the patient, you're going to have a problem. Listen to this. One of the many Christian religious sects is a group called the Jehovah's Witnesses, which is several centuries old. Followers of the sect believe in the imminent end of the world and in strictly following the literal words and commands of the Bible. One of these biblical commands is contained in Genesis chapter 9, which states that the consumption of blood is forbidden. In keeping with their literal approach, the Jehovah's Witnesses traditionally would not eat blood sausages or blood puddings. They never had any serious conflicts with the medical profession until the 1940s, when blood transfusions and the technology of blood storage in blood banks became standardized and commonplace. Well, in 1945, a Jehovah's Witness publication called The Watchtower stated that blood transfusions were akin to consuming blood. So in September of 1963, a young man named Jesse E. Jones brought his wife into the hospital operated by the Georgetown College in Washington, D.C. Georgetown College is now Georgetown University, whose hospital is a world-famous institution. Mrs. Jones, age 25, and the mother of a seven-month-old child, had suffered a ruptured ulcer and lost two-thirds of her blood. The Joneses were both Jehovah's Witnesses. When Dr. Edwin Westura, the chief medical resident, said that Mrs. Jones would die unless given a blood transfusion, and Mr. Jones refused to permit it. Responsible for Mrs. Jones' life, Georgetown had its lawyers, Peter R. Taft, Harold Ungar, and the famous Edward Bennett Williams, go to the courts for permission to give the necessary blood transfusions without Jones' consent. On September the 17th, 1963, the attorneys went to Judge Edward A. Tam's chambers at the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia and asked for an emergency order allowing the hospital to save Mrs. Jones' life. Judge Tam refused, and at 4 p.m. on the same day, the attorneys went to the chambers of Judge J. Skelly Wright of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, asking for an immediate review of Tam's decision. Judge Wright telephoned the hospital, and Dr. Westura confirmed that Mrs. Jones would die without a blood transfusion. Wright then went to the hospital with the attorneys, where he met Jones. Jones remained firm in his refusal to grant consent. Father Bunn, Georgetown's president, even came to plead with Jones, all to no avail. Westura and the other doctors assigned to the case tried without success to explain that a transfusion is completely different from drinking blood. At 5:20 p.m., Wright signed the orders prepared by the attorneys, and Mrs. Jones was given blood transfusions that saved her life. On September 19, 1963, Wright filed a memorandum concerning his actions, which recited various legal precedents permitting courts to act in preservation of human life, and he ended by saying, "The final and compelling reason for granting the emergency writ was that a life hung in the balance. There was no time for research and reflection. Death could have mooted the cause in a matter of minutes if action were not taken to preserve the status quo. To refuse to act, only to find later that the law required action, was a risk I was unwilling to accept. I determined to act on the side of life." Well, on October the 14th, 1963, Jones' attorneys, Ralph H. Deckelbaum and Bernard Margolius, filed a petition for rehearing before the full Court of Appeals to quash Wright's September 17th order. On February 3, 1964, the Court of Appeals denied Jones' petition because Mrs. Jones had long since recovered and left the hospital. There was a spirited dissent, however, by Circuit Judge Warren Berger, who later became Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Berger felt that the fact that Jones had signed a release upon bringing his wife to the hospital took the case out of the court's jurisdiction. In effect, the college had to rely on the release for legal protection without court help. Jones appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, but his attorney's petition was denied without comment on June 15, 1964. Even though the 1960s was an era of increasing civil liberties, the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Earl Warren refused to overturn the Court of Appeals' de facto approval of Judge Wright's actions to save Mrs. Jones' life. And although the Supreme Court and the judicial system were increasingly sensitive to the rights of religious minorities, they drew the line when religious sensibilities meant that modern medical technology would be denied to a person in need. Well, Jones' mistake was in taking his wife to the hospital. If you don't want a particular medical treatment, then don't take your child to the hospital. If you go to the hospital to have a baby, you have to sign a document called an admission slip, an admission contract. If you were to have read that admission contract, which is pretty lengthy and filled with fine print, you would find that you agree to hold the hospital harmless for anything they do to you. Medical malpractice has to be some act that the hospital does in which they don't follow the medical protocols. Now, they can cut, burn, and poison. And if they killed you in the process, that's a part of the protocol. They can give you a blood transfusion with HIV and kill you. That's according to the protocols, and you agree to that when you sign in. Now, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that you're injured in an automobile accident, you're bleeding very badly, and there's an ambulance there, and you say, "No, no, don't take me to the hospital, leave me alone. I don't want to go to the hospital." They load you in the meat wagon and haul you off anyway. When you get to the hospital, you and or your surrogate say, "No, no, I don't want a transfusion. I don't want your services." And they take you in anyway, against your will and over your objection. They perform life-saving heroics on you, and you survive, and you come out later. Now you've got grounds for an action. Now you can do something. In fact, you'll find that the hospital won't act for you unless you agree. But once you've agreed and you've signed in, don't complain about the services given to you, even if you object to the
contract. Where that game is played. Done under contract. Oh, we're out of time. Get back here in 3 minutes, half an hour, whatever it may be. Richard Holmquist.